from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 2009 in Rochester. It was the launch of the Good Food Collective. The Good Food Collective aims to put local farms, organic farms especially, in touch with customers who might not otherwise find them. And they took the approach of going to businesses, going to offices, offering them the chance to have a weekly order, a kind of seasonal approach, season by season, to find out what local farms were doing. They would bring it to your office. The office members would have a chance to get their shares. And again, otherwise, these are the kind of folks who might not be connecting with these farms. Is it working? How big have they grown now? Well, they started with 100 customers, 1,600 customers. This coming summer for the Good Food Collective, and the founder and president is Chris Hartman. He's in studio with us now. Chris, welcome back to Connections.
Yeah, well, it's a pleasure, Evan. I really appreciate you having us in.
It's great to have you back. There's so much interest, and I know we're going to talk more about specifics later, but how many members right now of the Good Food Collective?
Well, we're gearing up for our sixth season here, and our current goals and targets are about 1,600 summer members. But at this point, we're offering spring membership, summer membership, fall membership, and we're just finishing this week today, actually, our winter membership. And our numbers, you know, sort of vary across those different seasons. But the summer, the bulk of our focus and the big part of our program, about 1,600 members this year is our expectation.
You had this vision for this win. Take me back to the beginning.
Well, this actually, the specifics of the Good Food Collective really were born out of the work that went into the South Wedge Farmers Market. And, you know, when I moved back to Rochester, which is where I'm from originally, I had been just spent about 8 years working on a grass-based dairy farm down in the Hudson Valley, actually, and had spent a lot of time through the work on that farm, engaging with the local community there, talking about local sustainable food systems and how communities can put that together. When we moved off the farm and back into Rochester, we moved into downtown Rochester really with the idea, this is my wife and I, with the idea that we were excited to move into an urban environment and really work off the farm, but still around local food issues, around supporting local farmers and organic agriculture. So we worked within the South Wedge community to really develop the South Wedge Farmers Market. We worked with a lot of neighborhood residents there that were interested in access to good food. We worked with a lot of farmers that were having a hard time sort of differentiating themselves at the public market or in other venues. And we put together the makings of what became Rochester's first producer-only, sustainably oriented farmers market in the South Wedge. So that project really was a jump start for us as far as connecting with local farmers and connecting with enthusiasts here in Rochester that were thinking about food. And truthfully, we came in swinging with that project. We were really excited to have that farmers market be a model of how communities start to put together action plans to create real change in the food system. Through that project, we were able to connect with other neighborhoods and help establish other farmers markets. The West Side Farmers Market was a project we started a year or two after the South Wedge. We worked closely with the Monroe Village Task Force to begin their farmers market. We worked with Brighton to help them start their market. And really, we saw this as a neat way to again, support local sustainable farmers. But it didn't take too long into that project to realize, as great as that project was, particularly for the communities that now had these farmers markets in their neighborhoods, these projects had some significant limitations, whether it was the seasonality of the farmers markets, the once-a-week opportunity to connect with them. You know, those sorts of things became challenging pieces to imagine that this was going to be the answer to how we're going to change a food system in Rochester. And in fact, there's been a lot of research about that throughout all of this. And as, at least this is a few years ago old now, but to people's best estimations, even for the thriving marketplaces that are packed with people and moving a lot of food, your best guess would be, or your best hope would be, that about 2-3% of the local food dollars being spent would move through that farmers market. So you've still got another 97% of food that's being purchased and consumed in the community that obviously is a huge opportunity to figure out how to connect our local farmers to that food marketplace.
Now, before you go forward, let me back up and ask you again. You're originally from Rochester?
Originally from Rochester, yep.
And you ended up in the Hudson Valley, but did you grow up the kind of person who was looking for sustainable agriculture, local food. I mean, I grew up, blessed my mother, a wonderful, wonderful woman, but I only saw vegetables that came out of a can that were gray and pallid. And it took me driving through the Finger Lakes seeing a Mennonite food stand that woke me up to the amazing possibilities. Did you grow up seeing agriculture a little more closely and with more interest?
No, I think my story sounds very similar to yours. Although my grandfather was an avid, you know, home-style scale vegetable grower, I have some great childhood memories of trying to grow strawberries with my grandfather, the crop not working out, and him behind my back or before I got out there, toothpicking strawberries to the plants so that I would think we had a crop that we could go out there and pick. I think that's part of my optimistic approach in the world. But no, not a lot of experience farming growing up. When I went to college, I actually was an education major, and education is still a big part of my life and an important
part of
the work.
Well, that's part of the ethos of Good Food Collective.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah. Yep. So, and truthfully, my skill set and my role as an educator, I often see as one of the most valuable toolboxes, as it were, around entrepreneurial and business management and organizing this project in general. But anyways, I was an education major at college, but not interested in necessarily traditional classroom settings as far as my future teaching goals, interested in out-of-the-school or community-based youth development projects. The environment was a big focus of mine and a big part of my growing up, so although farming and food wasn't, camping and being outside and in general, being stewards of the environment, that was a part of my family's value system and a part of what I grew up with. So I was interested in environmental education, and in the college I went to had an internship program, and I ended up trying to look around for interesting stuff going on in the world of education, and I ended up at a farm that was working with school kids to have them come out to the farm, see what it was like to, you know, take care of cows. And it was kind of a small homesteading operation, a few milking cows, a small flock of sheep, some chickens, some vegetable gardens, an orchard, things like that. So I came there interested in education and ultimately fell in love with farming. I ended up doing my thesis project, developing a residential program for high school students to come and live and work on the farm, milk the cows in the morning, cook dinner together at night, and have sort of activities and discussions around social and environmental justice issues and things like that. But I ended up staying at that farm for about 7 years. And after a year or two of developing educational programs, I became farm manager. The small homesteading style farm that we had received $1 million grant to build a state-of-the-art creamery. We built our herd out of Jersey Browns, developed a lot around grass-based rotation and dairy farming in that way. And again, I just sort of continued to fall in love with farming. And so, part of that farm, the neat thing about it was a not-for-profit farm with an educational focus. So we really had the privilege, and I see it as that, the privilege to worry a little less about the farming financial bottom line, in that grants did a lot to support the efforts. It gave us $1 million we needed to build that creamery,
et cetera. In the Hudson Valley?
In the Hudson Valley.
What was the farm?
Sprout Creek Farm.
Okay, so I know Sprout Creek. I know Pocanico.
Yep.
So I know a number of the operations.
Yep, Hawthorne Valley down there runs a great program. Sprout Creek Farm, we had, again, the privilege there to really think about what does sustainable agriculture look like in the dairy world, and what does it look like to connect with your local community and be part of creating, you know, again, socially and environmentally responsible sources of food. So that was my entrance into the food world. And like I said, moving back to Rochester, we were very excited to continue that work, but more in the community organizing, entrepreneurial side of things.
Okay, so you had this vision that was developing. You saw this opportunity. But did you have a sense for how big it could get? And nobody knows, I don't think anybody exactly knows right now, in 5 or 10 years how big you will be or what the scope of it will be. We'll talk about that coming up here. But did you have a sense early on what you really thought it would look like?
Well, like I said, our original vision was a lot around these farmers markets. And I think a really important part of our story was about 2 years into running the South Wedge Farmers Market, as we sort of continued to get involved in projects around Rochester and then continued to look at projects around the country that were role models for us. We began the process of developing a 501c3. We're going to start our own not-for-profit. It seemed like a no-brainer. We were going to, you know, organize neighborhood-based farmers markets and then do other work and organizing and educational efforts around local food and supporting local farms. We got an attorney on board, pro bono. We were writing our articles of incorporation in that way. And somewhere in the middle of that, I came to the opinion, like many others, that, boy, what we don't maybe need is more not-for-profit organizations trying to support and facilitate an economy around local food. We need new businesses and new business models being that economy around local and sustainable foods. So using the same mission-oriented stance, the same value propositions, we scrapped the 501c3 process and incorporated as Headwater Foods Incorporated, and started a program that looked at farmers markets and the projects that we could sort of scale up from then to grow an economy around local food. So like I said, we were focused on farmers markets. As wonderful as those projects were, we started early on recognizing the limitations that they were as well, that they were great for the neighborhoods, great for some of the farmers that were participating, but also a really inefficient way to move food into a community and a really challenging way for farmers to move foods into the community, depending on the market. Are people going to show up? Is it going to rain that day? How much should I harvest? How much am I going to have to bring home? And how do I afford stopping the farming activities and loading up trucks and standing in parking lots all day? You know, it's a challenging proposition depending on the scale of the farm and the farmer's market itself. So anyways, we started to work together with our core group of farmers that have been part of this market to think about, okay, what else could we do then? What else is available? And what we realized, and really the founding's creative thought around the Good Food Collective was, boy, as inefficient as this is, you know, I got 20 farmers all coming to the same parking lot, standing here for 5 hours, hoping they'll sell everything they brought. The flip side is I've got a real asset here. We got 20 farmers all driving to the same parking lot in downtown Rochester. This is got to be a great way that we can utilize that asset and connect more people with good food in this community. So that's where we started to sit down and meet with farmers after the farmers market or on other days and really start to brainstorm what we could do. And that's the birthplace of the Good Food Collective. Now, you know, the story is quite elaborate from there as well, in the sense that, you know, we looked at CSA models as maybe a great next start, recognized some really beautiful aspects to those business models, but some limitations as well. So we really started to think about, all right, how do we borrow from the CSA model, but really look to scale that up both for consumers and get more people involved in eating through a program like CSA and allow more farmers to participate as well.
What was a limitation that you saw in the CSA model?
The CSAs are such a fantastic model as far as the real focus on relationship between farmers and eaters, the real focus on bringing people to the same side of the fence, the sharing of the risk, the forming community, the face to the food. It's really an exciting project that is so true to the values that sort of create it, and so impressive as far as the purity and the beauty of the model that it is. But CSA is not about convenience, for example. It's not about, how do I make good choices and eat good food when I've got an incredibly busy life and I'm running all over the place and I barely have time to grocery shop, let alone drive out to a farm and pick up my weekly share. And it's not about convenience. And we saw that as a real limitation for wide adoption as far as people participating in that sort of model. We could also go down we could spend a whole day talking about this as well, but I see real limitations to the shared risk proposition as well. And I don't believe the farmer should have that risk, but I also don't believe just the consumer should have that risk.
Well, I think it's worth talking for just a minute.
Yeah.
And you're right. I mean, you could spend an hour or a day on these subjects.
Yes.
And I also know that to some degree, local farms, you know, when we talk to local farmers, as we did earlier this week, we've talked to some who do think, and I'm not speaking for all, who've mm-hmm. told us that there is value in a CSA, knowing that your customers are supporting you, sort of rain or shine, disaster or not, that you're getting that kind of support. That there is going to be risk. But when you talk about limitations, I know you're not offending anybody. Mm-hmm. You're looking at it just from all sides of it here. What's the limitation with risk sharing there?
Well, and this to me, and we're truthfully getting a little over my head as well as far as expertise, but this is a big and important one. So there's serious risks associated with farming. I very much agree. I see it. I've watched it. I've experienced it myself. And I am a big proponent of the fact that farmers should not stand alone, you know, bearing the risk of potential failure, you know, on a given year. That said, I don't believe we should just shift that to farmers and individual families and eaters necessarily trying to manage that risk alone. That said, I think CSA is doing a really exciting and really interesting job at doing just that. And I think it makes sense, depending on the scale. If you're really talking about a food system for the country, though, I think there's a lot of important thinking and creative thinking to do around other ways to manage that risk. And whether it's larger groups that are allowing crop insurance to be a more affordable, more viable, and more fair system that support farmers and eaters around the risk of food, I think there's some creative thinking there. When you look at just the aspect of subsidy in general and the fact that we've pulled the risk out of corn, soybean, and cotton, it would be interesting to try and glean learned lessons from that and think about small organic fruit growers and vegetable growers and talk about how we pull some of the risk out of that as a community, as a society, as opposed to individual farmers and eaters. Again, I think what CSA doing is beautiful, and I think it's a action-oriented, immediate response to a real need. But I don't see it as necessarily a societal, you know, structure for how we should really move forward long-term.
Okay.
And not that I'm providing that answer necessarily either, but the farmers we work with, some of which run their own CSAs and some of which have opted not to go that model, we still talk a lot about sharing and managing risk with our farmers. And although we don't, you know, if the entire tomato crop of a particular farm fails, we do not pay them for that tomato crop that failed. We work closely with that farmer, however, to figure out what else is viable and what else our members can utilize from that farm, and thus what we can still be purchasing and working with that farmer around.
Okay, so unlike some CSA arrangements where, again, if a crop fails, mm-hmm. you're still on the hook for paying them, and that's part of the deal that you know you're getting into.
Yep.
Good Food doesn't pay for failed crops, but you will look for other solutions to support.
Yep, and we work with farmers. What we are providing farmers, because this is a really important conversation, and Liz Henderson locally and a variety of the fantastic CSA farms, I know you had Dennis and Emma and a lot of great CSAs here, and they can speak eloquently to the sort of the real value and the philosophy that's trying to be pushed forward there, and I really do support all that. What we're doing with our farmers, we're not sharing the risk in that way, but we're providing a substantial marketplace for everything that does successfully grow out of their fields. We are buying that at pre-agreed fair prices with our farmers. We're buying in significant volume in a one-stop, you know, drop it all off at the Headwater Food Hub so that it can get packaged and ready for the Good Food Collective. So we'll take all the food at once. It's a guaranteed sale, assuming they can harvest it from their fields and deliver it to us. And it's at a pre-arranged price that we've agreed on as a fair price with the farmers. That's from all of our farmers, the resounding reply we get is, that's exactly what we want right now.
How many farms?
We're working with about 30 to 40 different mm-hmm. farmers at this point.
And as far away as and as close as?
We've got our most of our farmers are truthfully within, most of our substantial farmers are within kind of 10 to 20 miles of us, actually. But we've started to try and really reach out a little bit. And we'll talk maybe more about this in the hour, but the Good Food Collective is part of Headwater Food Hub. A food hub is sort of a growing and sort of existing buzzword in the local sustainable food system, but we're an aggregation point where we can connect with small and mid-sized farmers, pool that food together, and move it out into the community in a variety of different ways. The Good Food Collective is our favorite and most important version of that, but we're also strongly focused on farm-to-school efforts, farm-to-institution efforts, and connecting with local chefs and restaurants to supply them with this food.
Yeah, we'll talk about that coming up here. I just want to remind our listeners, we're talking to Chris Hartman, the founder and president of Headwater Foods and the Good Food Collective. Most of our listeners are going to be much more familiar with the Good Food Collective, but we will talk about Headwater because they were born together back in 2009. So your first year, you had how many members?
So that first year when we opted to, you know, explore the CSA model, but how do we scale this up? How do we try and hold on to some aspects that are beautiful, but also potentially walk away with some aspects that we just don't think scale well?
Because some of your customers said, oh, I'm in a CSA, I'm with Good Food. And
right.
You have to remind people we're not
We are not a CSA.
CSA.
We are not a CSA. That's absolutely true. What we are, though, is a membership-style program that's trying to build community, support local organic farmers, and connect busy people with the good food that they'd like to have. And so it's a model unto itself in some ways, but increasingly there's a lot of versions like it out there that we're gleaning, good ideas from. So that first year, the aspects of it that were obvious to us as far as scaling up, on the farmer side, instead of one farm trying to grow 60 different crops for, 100 or 200 or whatever amount of families, a lot of farmers had a hard time imagining, A, that diversity, growing that many crops, and having to service families in that way. I mean, there's a risk associated with becoming a CSA from the farmers of just, oh my gosh, what if the crops do fail? It's not just an economic thing. Yeah, I'll still get the money, but how am I going to feel about that? Can I sustain this business long term? And can I grow 60 different things? So on that side, on the production side, we decided to develop a multi-farm CSA-like project, which is how we started calling it at first, a multi-farm CSA, where we would have different farmers growing the crops that worked well for them, their soils, their infrastructure, their personalities, but focus on, 4 to 10 different crops that they could pool together with other farmers to contribute what would go ultimately into a volume-oriented, diversified share of the Good Food Collective. But they could focus, again, on what works well for them. We also, again, in our model, wanted the farmers to stay on the farm, to keep farming and focus their time and their labor force in that way and have an ability to drop off that food or us pick up that food and take it from there as far as putting together the membership program. On the consumer side, again, one of the things we wanted to move away from was what we like to think of as a hyper-convenient model. So the Good Food Collective, right from the beginning, was how do we connect with people? How do we fit into their busy lives? How do we help people make good choices that we know they want to make but are having a really hard time figuring out where or how or when they would do something like that? So our very first approach to the Good Food Collective was, let's think about workplace-based delivery. Mm-hmm. Let's connect with people at the workplace when they're already there and give them a beautiful bag, now a box, that they could sort of take home from the workplace with them and really try and dovetail in their lives and give them a way that fits and allows them to make the good choices they want. So to answer your question, that first year running around to different businesses saying, yeah, don't worry, people pay up front, but no, we're going to be there every week. We're going to drop off your food. Yeah, no, don't worry.
Isn't it interesting that 6 years later, that seems so ingrained, people understand it, but you had to explain then it was kind of a new concept.
Because
it,
and really an important part of this project from the get-go is we're not trying to take away CSA members or compete with CSAs. We're trying to look at a whole new radius of people that probably would love to participate in something like that, but are not the low-hanging fruit, quote-unquote.
Otherwise wouldn't,
exactly right. So, yeah, we were in the thick of people who are like, what? And I don't get to pick my vegetables? That doesn't make sense. And so just a whole lot of explaining, and understandably so. But that first year, we had the University of Rochester, RIT, Nixon Peabody, the law firm, and a bunch of other really great progressive employers that were like, you know what? We get it. It makes sense. They may have even had an employee wellness or a sustainability committee that was really getting it and excited to push forward. And ultimately, we got 100 members to sign up that first year.
Were you thinking that was a good number?
I was shocked. and just really excited. Mind you, we were still running the farmer's market at that point, and this really was an outgrowth of the farmer's market. In fact, that first year, the 100 members, the way it worked, again, building on the asset of I got 20 farmers all coming to the same parking lot, farmers that were participating with the Good Food Collective would bring the food they were planning to sell to the farmer's market on Thursday, as well as the food they were going to contribute to those 100 shares for the Good Food Collective. And myself and a few high school interns that I had at the farmer's market and working for the Good Food Collective, under a tent to the side, would organize all of that food, pack it into these bags and boxes, and put it into a refrigerated trailer that I converted from an old carpenter's trailer. And I would drive that trailer home at the end of the night. I hope there's no food safety people listening right now. We're much better than this now, by the way. But I would drive that trailer home at the end of the night.
Your colleagues are looking at you like, why are you
going? I snaked an extension cord out the kitchen window, and I would plug the air conditioner unit in that was rewired as part of that trailer to keep it a consistent 45 degrees in there. The next morning, I would wake up and drive to those 5 area businesses and drop off those boxes. That was the birth of the Good Food Collective.
Do you remember the first drop-off?
I do as well. I've still got pictures of it. Yep.
What were you thinking when you saw? Did you think this is working? People are getting this.
I knew from the beginning that we were on to something. I just had a feeling that so much of this project was born out of the people that were at the table of just like, this was our problem. I mean, at the time, and this is why we started the South Wedge Farmers Market. I was part of a CSA, a raw milk buying club, a meat buying club. It felt like a full-time job running around to all the different farms or the random garages that people were organizing things in or whatever to get the food we wanted. It just seemed crazy. And I knew from the beginning of, man, if we could figure out a way to connect people in more convenient ways, but hold on to the trust that was so much a part of this, hold on to the real relationships and the feeling that they had as far as, yes, we're doing something good. Yes, we're supporting farmers. Our money is going where we want it to, and we're getting the food. I just knew if we could put those pieces together, this would make sense. By the way, we haven't totally figured this out yet either, and we're still endlessly learning.
Well, it's evolving, sure.
Learning.
And anybody who's seen what you've done over the years, and we're going to talk in just a moment with Shannon Prozeller, the director of the Good Food Collective, about where it is now, because I know some of our listeners might be wondering about some of getting involved and what that entails. But before I get to a quick break, let me just ask you one more question.
Mm-hmm.
Do you hear from some farms who do view you as competition?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And we really appreciate that conversation. And the farms that are able to reach out with us and dialogue in that way, often part of it is miscommunications or misperceptions about either what we're actually doing and or what we're trying to do or where we're going from here. But I also think often, and we'll get a chance to talk to Stefan as well, our supply chain director here, but often those conversations are the beginning points for us to talk about how we potentially could work well with those farmers as well. And I think probably 90% of the time when those conversations begin, we end up in a working relationship after that in mutually beneficial ways.
On Twitter, Sarah says, love, love, love. Great variety, good price, lots of locations, excellent customer service, and a bunch of fun people. That's a nice endorsement for Chris and the group. We're talking about the Good Food Collective and Headwater Foods. After this short break, we will talk about getting involved. 100 that first season. They're looking at 1,600 members for their upcoming summer season. More in just a second on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. We're talking about the Good Food Collective, which is a project of Headwater Foods. Headwater Foods founded back in 2009. Good Food Collective, as you've been hearing from Chris Hartman, the founder this hour, has grown from 100 members from those early days about 6 years ago to potentially up to about 1,600 this summer. And they now do it in a sort of a seasonal fashion. And I want to bring in Shannon Prozeller, who is the director of the Good Food Collective. Shannon, forgive me for asking, but we're always curious in the doldrums of winter when it feels like nothing is growing. What did you eat last night?
Yes, great question, and thanks for having us.
Sure.
Well, the winter season, despite what many may think is not much available, we are able to pull together quite a bunch of great, great things to eat around the table. Last night I enjoyed some pasta from Flower City Pasta, which we have available through the Good Food Collective, and really just a medley of a bunch of veggies given in our share this week for the winter season that included some greens, some beets, and diced peppers from our processed partner in the Hudson Valley, and some olive oil, fresh garlic, and lemon juice.
So you're eating just fine.
Yes, I am. I could say that.
That's the interesting thing about the Good Food Collective, at least from my perspective. I haven't seen it on every step from the beginning, but you do it now seasonally?
We do. We are year-round, four seasons of the year. and you can become a member of anyone or all together. It's really up to you, whatever fits best.
And we had questions already about whether you cap members or there's a deadline, say for spring, for example.
We do.
Did we miss the deadline?
You did not miss the deadline.
Okay.
And we are up and running on our website. All of our seasons are available. And the season of spring starts the week of May 4th. That runs 6 weeks through mid-June, and then we'll be ramping up for our summer season right after that, the week of June 22nd, which runs for 14 weeks through September. Then following that, we ramp up for our fall season. That goes through November, through the Thanksgiving week, and then we start back up our winter season in the month of January.
So okay. And so again, you've got members who do year-round, you've got members who do it seasonally.
Correct.
If you wanted to sign up for spring, for example, is there a deadline?
The deadline is, for each season, the Monday before it begins.
Wow, so it's right tied up there. And is there sort of a cap on membership?
There is, yes. The May season of spring, it's one of our smallest seasons. Spring and mm-hmm. winter are two of our smallest seasons, just in terms of, you know, what all that is available and what we're able to offer. We will be capping our spring membership at 300 members this year. And then our summer, which is much, much larger, summer and fall, will be right around the 1,600 mark.
Wow. And again, forgive me, are you nearing that 300 total already, though, if people wanted to get involved now?
We are well on our way. There's definitely some more spots available, and we'll be continuing to sell through, let's see, the 27th of April or until it sells out.
What happens if nothing grows all year and it never gets warmer than 30 degrees, how it feels? That's not going to happen, right?
It is not going to happen. It may feel like it, but
I mean, I've barely seen crocuses. But things are finally going to stir. Spring looks like what? What does a spring share typically look like? Asparagus?
Yeah, great question. The spring is definitely for those diehard fans that are just really excited about what is becoming available in those early months of the year. And you can expect, for one, a lot of fresh greens, which are, you know, more widely available in terms of what you're able to grow during that time. Members can receive and expect things like spinach, arugula, fresh salad mix, asparagus, definitely a loved item towards the end of the season, and strawberries especially. Hopefully we'll hit that timing right to either hit the end of spring or the first beginning of summer for the strawberries.
And then so you go from maybe 300 members to 1,600 for summer when things are really rocking. What about fall?
Fall is also a really exciting season and probably my favorite, actually. The summer is a lot of those, you know, great veggies that you are used to, you know, tomatoes, cucumbers, peppers, green beans, sugar snap peas, all that great stuff. But once you get into fall, it's really a lot of the hearty root veggies, mm-hmm. crops like kale, Swiss chard, cabbages and Brussels sprouts. We'll get into a lot of great winter squash, spaghetti squash, buttercup, acorn, my favorite, delicata squash, things like that.
Membership change, 1,600 in summer to how many in fall?
Right about the same, actually.
Okay, so really the big seasons for you are summer and fall. And then what's fascinating is we're still finishing up winter here, and people say, well, how do you do a Good Food Collective in winter? And then they see the list, you know, pasta. You still doing coffees?
We are. So we've got a variety of additional shares. Aside from just the produce, we do pasta, eggs, cheese, coffee, bread, pork, beef, and chicken. We've got a deli share. Lots of great stuff. In terms of produce, we do a lot of stored roots. Mm-hmm. So members receive each distribution. They get an array of roots to actually choose from, whatever they would like, with a choice of potatoes, onions, carrots, kohlrabi, beets, onions, all that great stuff. And then we also do a lot of stored apples, which is pretty significant in terms of, you know, what is able to be stored. Great varieties like Gala, Empire, Crispin, Granny Smith, a lot of good stuff there, and especially in our region, a loved item for sure. And then we also do some processed foods that members can receive and enjoy through the winter that were actually harvested in the summertime. We work with a processor in the Hudson Valley called Winter Sun Farms, and they provide things like diced peppers, edamame, green beans, corn, things like that.
Okay, so when it comes to, for example, in the winter share, when it comes to food that is not coming from farms, give me a quick example of the businesses you're working with. In the past, I've seen Joe Bean Coffee.
Yes.
That's still on the list?
They are.
All right, Joe Bean Coffee, you mentioned Flower City Pasta.
Mm-hmm.
A couple other examples.
Yeah. Flower City Bread. Mm-hmm. Keith Myers over there. We are working with a variety of cheese producers. We've got Lively Run, Engelbert Farms, Miranda Cheese, First Light Creamery, which also does our yogurt share. We work with, let's see, for our pork, beef, and chicken, we work with Interbrook Farms for our pork share. The chicken comes from Fisher Hill Farm in Canandaigua, and the beef share comes from Sweetgrass Meats in Naples.
Mark on Twitter wanted to know, how do I get them to come to our office? Do you still
Great
work with
question.
New locations?
Yes, we absolutely do. And our pre-boxed share program is something that we've really ramped up these last 2 years and are continuing to really grow in that way, connecting with local businesses, especially, you know, those that have great health and wellness initiatives, mm-hmm. want to get their employees involved, and employees that don't really have the time to be running around to one of our public spots, we can deliver right to their workplace. Right now is the prime time to be reaching out to us. If you are interested, people can email us and let us know, and we'll talk all the details and figure it out what day of delivery through the summer and fall seasons.
Do you need a minimum order or a minimum number of people involved in your office?
We do. We say between, I'd say, 8 to 10 people as a minimum. And as long as you've got that base, we will be there each and every week with your fresh produce box.
Before I turn it over to Stefan Schwartz, who's the supply chain director, am I missing anything here, Shannon? I mean, I feel like what's interesting is how much Good Food Collective is beyond a CSA. And again, please let nobody in the listening audience today think that we're denigrating CSA in any way. What we're trying to do is show how GFC is not a CSA, not trying to put CSA down, it's just sort of beyond that. But, you know, what am I missing before I turn it over to Stefan?
Thank you. Absolutely. I would say our website is a great resource for people that would like to find more about us and even just the joy of cooking and exploring food more. We've got a great recipe blog that we put a lot of time into to allow our members to really experience and learn and grow with us what is available, what to do with it, things like that, as well as a lot of information about our farms and producers that we work with, what their growing practices are, what their farming philosophy is. So I would say if you have any more questions or are, you know, wanting to find more, definitely visit our website. And
what's the website?
The website is thegoodfoodcollective.com.
With the on the front of it.
Thegoodfoodcollective.com. You got it.
All right. Thanks for taking the time. Shannon Prozeller is the director of the Good Food Collective. And I want to bring in Stefan Schwartz now.
Thank you.
Stefan is the supply chain director who's been on board since 2011. And Stefan, I want to talk about a number of things with you. First of all, though, you look like a farmer. Are you a farmer?
Oh, wow, that's a great compliment. I'm actually not. I've worked on a couple of farms post-college, actually in college as well, and I recently returned from the Peace Corps where I was working with farmers as well. So,
where were you in the Peace Corps?
I was in Nicaragua on the Atlantic coast, and it was beautiful. I actually just returned in September, so this winter has been a great welcome home.
And what did you do in Nicaragua?
I was working with farmers on a food security program, and I actually ended up getting involved in an infrastructure-style program, working with grants through the State Department to build a bridge and try to fix a road.
Wow. And so now here you are back with Good Food Collective, and I want to talk a little bit about the mission. We say Good Food Collective, but again, really with Headwater
yep.
Foods. And should I at least ask to differentiate when people hear Good Food Collective and Headwater Foods, and mainly with the easy explanation of what the difference is?
Yeah, so Headwater Food Hub is the umbrella company. The Good Food Collective is our most well-known and the first project that sort of drove that company forward. And now we have Headwater Food Hub, which is our wholesale side of things. So it is a little confusing, but once you get it, it makes sense. So Headwater Food Hub is both the umbrella and the wholesale side of the company. And then we have the Good Food Collective as well.
And there are some really interesting projects that are going on right now. So take me through some of the things that are starting to happen that you're working on when it comes to schools and chefs and all these things that are happening.
So this is potentially one of the most exciting things we're doing right now. We're conducting a USDA feasibility study, and that's taking kind of both sides of the equation, using some consulting professionals and using our own staff and our own relationships with, you know, schools and customers in the Rochester area, surveying them, holding focus groups, kind of seeing what the demand is, not only in terms of quantity, but what they're interested in, what the holdups are in terms of their investment in local foods. And then on my side, looking at supply. Farms, you can't just start a farm in one day. And we are blessed to be living in an agriculturally rich area. So, you know, talking with farmers and trying to continually align some of those, some of the customer demands with the supply. That being said, you know, we are so excited about the potential for growth here in Rochester to support more local businesses with local foods, which is what people are really interested in. And as I believe Chris mentioned, we have a slow growth philosophy. We're very, very values driven. And we refuse to grow or to, you know, invest in anything without this relationship building that we take so seriously. We're really aligned with our farmers, and so we want to talk to them. We want to understand how they're feeling, and we want to grow with the farm. So that's the most exciting side of my job for sure.
It's interesting in 6 years to see what's happened here, but are there models for this in other municipalities, other regions around the country?
We haven't found anyone that has this exact two-branch business model that we have, but actually Chris and myself just returned from San Francisco visiting a large food hub, which was one of the first in the country and was really one of the drivers of the certified organic movement that is now so prevalent. And they are doing amazing things, and it is inspirational to be around people trying to do the same thing. Sometimes we get caught in our bubble and forget that there's other people out there trying to do similar things.
How did you get the relationship with the USDA? I mean, how do you go about securing that? Is that a question for Chris?
That is a question for Chris. Yeah, so that whole process actually occurred when I was still in Central America doing, and my mind was in other places.
Yeah, you're off traveling the world, not really doing any real work.
Right. Exactly.
Not really contributing in Nicaragua and the Peace Corps. No, but seriously, going forward then, Stefan, before I kick back to Chris to kind of wrap it up, if these efforts are successful, what will we see happen in the next 12 months, 2 years, 3 years here?
Well, that's a great question. One kind of the end part of this feasibility study is looking at, you know, what the demand is, what the supply is, and then actually designing a new food hub for the Rochester area that we would occupy. And what we're looking at now is actually potentially being located in the Wayne Industrial Park and starting the nation's first carbon neutral food hub. They've got the big windmills out there and kind of harnessing that energy to run our own business.
Up off 104?
Yep.
Okay.
In terms of that, we are just we're closely working with schools, with chefs. We're talking about, you know, potentially processing broccoli florets, fresh greens. There are so many opportunities, and we just want to grow responsibly. And like I said, with our farmers. And so the next 12 months, it's hard to say, but we're definitely excited to continue to invest in the Rochester community with, you know, supplying local foods.
Let me just jump in and ask, when you talk about schools, for example, this has been a question now. You know, really forever for parents who send kids to school and wonder about food in schools. But I feel like in the last 5 to 10 years, it's really picked up an emphasis on really looking at what kids are consuming throughout the day, you know, whether it's school lunches or things like that. What do you see happening on that front?
Schools in particular, the public school system, it's definitely a challenge. And we are working with school administrators to try to start to move some products. The way I see it working, hopefully, is that, you know, we'll start with a few things that are grown, you know, in large quantities in Wayne County that we can get at the price point that makes sense for them. And then hopefully just continue to build that relationship. You know, a lot of it's about inroads and starting with what makes sense. But that is something we are really focused on. We work with some of the private schools in Rochester and have wonderful relationships with them. As you know, the public school system can be a little bit more difficult. There's just a little bit more to navigate.
So when I ask you 12 months, the reaction is, let's be patient. Let's have a good long-term philosophy, just like you said with the Good Food Collective, for example. 100 members to 1,600 in 6 years feels like a lot, but it has been sort of a reasonable growth, not too much at one time.
Yep. And I think that growth, will start to slow a little bit, maybe not. And it's all about, again, going back to the farmers and seeing what they're thinking. But yeah, in terms of the wholesale, in terms of the next 12 months, it's kind of a careful optimism, especially talking about schools. But again, it is something that we talk about every day and are super committed to.
Very interesting to talk to you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
Let me finish up with Chris Hartman, if I could. Again, the founder and president of Headwater Foods and the Good Food Collective is here as we talk about where they are in 2015 and going forward. So you really do feel like it's a slow growth mission, even though in 6 years, for example, just with the Good Food Collective, 100 members to 1,600 does feel pretty meteoric. You would say it's not sort of breakneck speed.
Well, it's there's no doubt it's been blurry, and exciting, and it is a lot of growth for us. I mean, it started off that first year, as I mentioned, me driving around Friday mornings. We now have an unbelievably talented and passionate staff, 4 refrigerated trucks, a 10,000 square foot warehouse. When I look back, one of my new favorite mottos these days or mantras is, we overestimate what we'll accomplish in a day and underestimate what we'll accomplish in a year. That very much feels like the story of my life these days. I get at the end of the day, I look at the list of things I was supposed to do. I didn't get to half of them. Yeah. It doesn't make sense. It feels like everything's taking forever. But yeah, I look back on the story and we've really grown. It's been really exciting. But that said, we are really committed, as Stefan's mentioned, and we're committed to responsible growth. We're committed. A lot of projects, I think, like ours, as Stefan mentioned, we were out in San Francisco. The food hub we were visiting is Veritable Vegetable, totally inspiring project that's started by these 3 women, just totally values-driven, totally stable, solid, really intelligent, wise approach to building a company. The next day we visited Good Eggs, and I'm not going to say that they're this necessarily this, but there's a lot of projects like this. They started 2 years ago with a $40 million venture capital investment. It's a Stanford tech startup-y type company. And again, solid. I think they'll do great, perhaps doing all kinds of good work, hopefully in the community. But I see a lot of things like that sort of boom and bust in a lot of ways. And we're really looking to avoid that. We're looking to invest in relationships, invest in this project long term, and create durable, lasting change in this area. So slow, steady, responsible growth is our goal.
For our listeners who might have missed part of the conversation, the websites to check out, thegoodfoodcollective.com. Where else would you have them go and learn more about what you're doing, Chris?
Well, I think that's a great place to get started, particularly in this program. As Stefan started to talk to, Headwater Food Hub, we're really looking forward to Rochester being unbelievably proud of this project and it being here. Our goal is to create upstate New York's premier food hub that's focused on sustainable organic agriculture. This area has the needs that we've mentioned, but New York State has a strong emphasis on supporting New York State farmers. The country has a strong emphasis on supporting, local farmers in various regions. So we're looking forward to growing that side of it and really establishing Headwater Foods in addition to the Good Food Collective in this area. So headwaterfoodhub.com is another website that gives, more background on what we're doing. People are welcome to check that out. We're also a very accessible team. We love connecting with people that are interested in this project, want to talk more about it, may have some critiques about it and/or some suggestions. We're into kind of a collective intelligence approach to building this project, so we love to hear from people.
Congratulations on your success. What are you having for dinner tonight?
Dinner tonight, great question. I wish I could give the eloquent answer. My wonderful wife, Vicky, is an unbelievably significant partner, both in this project and in just maintaining life. Thursday tonight, I will be at the last and final winter distribution with my team to kind of celebrate the close of winter. So I'll be standing in the South Wedge Farmers Market parking lot at Boulder Coffee from 4 to 6. I will pack up the truck with Shannon, drive it back to the hub, stow things away in the cooler. I will go home, and I know dinner will be beautiful. I have no idea what it's going to be.
When's the last time you went through a fast food drive-thru?
I actually, not that long ago, sadly, on the way.
By the way, yeah. I don't ask that to say anybody who's listening. I've been there.
Oh, yeah.
That was me earlier this week.
And actually, I shouldn't even say sadly, because I appreciate that question. I often... You know, people will think, oh, yeah, no, he started the good. This guy is all good, and he only eats this, that, and the other thing. And it's not at all the case.
Life doesn't always afford that.
I had a sausage, egg, and cheese sandwich at a throughway stop not that long ago. I felt a little queasy for a while afterwards, but,
it's like 60 seconds of raw pleasure and then 60 minutes of regret. Yeah.
But this is my critique, and it's the same with change. Everybody's supposed to change their light bulbs. Breaking this down to individual personal choices is a tough way to create significant change. Creating systems and approaches that people can interact with conveniently that allow them to live meaningful and good lives, make good choices, that's solutions in my mind. So
I think hearing that Chris Hartman, who founded the Good Food Collective in Headwater, stopped at a rest stop and grabbed a sausage, egg, and cheese muffin thing, is a reminder to us that nobody lives in an absolute world.
Absolutely.
And that nobody should feel bad if we can't reach whatever high standards we set. But we can all try to aim for something.
Exactly. Yeah, I appreciate exactly that philosophy.
Congratulations again. Thanks for being here. And it'll be fun to keep up with the Good Food Collective in Headwater.
Thanks so much for having us, Evan. It's been great.